with Dr. Keith Suter.
Hamas's political leader and mastermind behind the October 7 attack, Yahya Sinwar, was killed by Israeli military forces in Rafah this week. To talk about this and other world items, we welcome from Global Directions Dr. Keith Suter. Good morning, Keith. Thank you for joining us this morning.
Yes. Good morning, Brent.
As we said, Hamas's political leader and the mastermind behind the October 7 attack, Yahya Sinwar, was killed by Israeli military forces in Rafah. Sinwar orchestrated the assault that led to 1,200 deaths, of course, and the capture of those 250 hostages by Hamas. DNA has confirmed Sinwar's identity. He'd been hiding in tunnels and among civilians. Keith, could you start out by giving us a little bit of history of this Yahya Sinwar?
Yes, so Sinwar was born in 1962 in a refugee camp in Khan Yunis on the Gaza Strip. And most of his life was spent under Israeli jurisdiction because Israel invaded that area in 1967. He himself spent about a third of his life in an Israeli jail because he killed four Palestinian informers. And while he was in jail, he made the most of his 22 years. He learned Hebrew, studied his enemy, and believed that he worked out how he could fight them. He was released in the year 2011 when the Israelis released 1,000 Palestinian prisoners who were swapped for a single soldier, Corporal Jalid Shalit, who had lived in those tunnels, having been captured for about 5 years. So Shalit was released, and 1,000 Palestinian prisoners were also swapped at that time. So he then worked his way up through the ranks of Hamas on the Gaza Strip and probably did the most of the planning for the October 7 terrorist attack last year. And of course, that's been the worst ever defeat inflicted upon Israel since it was formed in 1948. So you've got people who are now still being held by Hamas, probably about 100. Obviously, there are well over 1,000 were killed, but there are 100 that we think are being kept in the tunnels, or perhaps may have died, and so their bodies are in those tunnels. On the Israeli side, they want to continue the struggle against Hamas until all of the Hamas fighters are removed from the scene and that the 100 or so captives have been released. That's the Israeli war aim. Now, others are saying, particularly led by the Americans, saying, look, we're very worried about how this war is continuing to drag on. Clearly, there's no one single indicator of defeat for Hamas. You can kill their leaders, but you've got new ones coming through who will continue the fight. So why not draw a line at this point? You've killed Sinwar, the mastermind of the October 7 terrorist attack. He was the leader of Hamas. Just draw a line across the page now and then wind down on the hostilities. So you've got two conflicting types of opinion. You've got Israel, the Israeli government, that wants to push on with the attack, even though some of their own soldiers are killed in the process, because Hamas continues to fight on. And the alternative point of view comes from America and some of Israel's allies who are saying, no, just finish at this point. You've got the mastermind of the October 7 terrorist attack. Much of Gaza is now destroyed. Most of the Hamas warriors have been killed. Draw a line across the page now and declare victory. And so you've got these two contrasting points of view. From the American point of view, I think particularly President Biden, there is a fear that the longer the war goes on, the greater is the risk that Arab Americans will not go out and vote for the Democrat candidate in November. Mm-hmm. They're not going to vote for Trump, but then they're not going to vote for the Democrat candidate either. And so they'll keep away from the polls. And the point I keep on saying about the American election is going to be settled by a handful of voters in a handful of states. So every vote counts. Last time around, it was 44,000 people out of a population total of over 300 million. So it just shows how narrowly balanced this election is going to be. So the Americans are saying to the Israelis, look, you've pretty well done it. Declare victory and let's move on. But the Israeli Prime Minister is saying, no, we want to continue the struggle.
Keith, how might Hezbollah's threat to escalate attacks affect Israel's military strategy? In other words, look, Hezbollah have come out and threatened again retaliation for this. I can't see it not happening, can you?
Well, Hezbollah, look, you've got two different groups here. So Hamas was the group in the Gaza Strip. They're the ones who pulled off the October 7 terrorist attack. The following day, Hezbollah, which is a different organization based in southern Lebanon, they decided on October 8th, the following day, to join in the struggle, saying that until the fighting in Gaza stops, they're going to continue their fight against Israel. So it's an opportunistic move which proved fatal for their leader, Hazrat Nasrallah, who was then killed by the Israelis a short time ago. They are saying that they're only fighting in northern Israel because the fighting is continuing in Gaza. The implication is that if the fighting stops in Gaza, Hezbollah will stop the attacks into northern Israel. 60,000 Israelis have moved from their homes and are living to live away from that border area. So we're talking about southern Lebanon, northern Israel, and the Israelis have been moved out for a year to avoid being killed by Hezbollah. The problem from the Israeli point of view is that Hezbollah is probably the best armed terrorist organization in the world. Very different from Hamas, which is a small irritant group, or they could certainly pull off amazing suffering, as we saw on October 7 last year. But Hezbollah, a different organization, is well armed. It's part of the Lebanese political system. It has good supply lines all the way through back to Iran, which controls much of its big picture thinking. And so Hezbollah could just simply say, we've got 130,000 rockets and missiles, etc., going to launch them all on Israel. You could certainly destroy the northern cities of Israel very easily, because the dome defensive system, which must be the Iron Dome, will simply be overwhelmed. It cannot cope with that number of missiles or rockets at the same time. So we could see a lot of destruction of Israel, potentially, if Hezbollah were to launch all of their supplies in one go. So it's a very different situation from Hamas, which is simply fighting down in the Gaza area. Hezbollah would be a major military force. And the last time that Hezbollah and Israel clashed, which was 18 years ago, the Israelis were held to a draw. And the Israelis are not used to just being held to a draw. And so that there's a psychological issue here, that Israeli soldiers are now being killed in southern Lebanon. Even something as basic as geography is important. Down in the Gaza Strip, they've built tunnels through the sand, which means that you can walk through the tunnels, but that's about it. Because of the sand, it's not good area for digging tunnels. Southern Lebanon, by contrast, is rock. And so I've seen some of the film footage of the trucks being able to be driven through these huge tunnels that have been built in southern Lebanon. So if the Israelis were to go further into southern Lebanon, they could find themselves up against a very sophisticated military force indeed. So you could imagine there are some people in Israel saying, look, let's find a way of getting out of all of this mess now, rather than risking a protracted conflict in southern Lebanon.
You've got Joe Biden, as you mentioned, talking about ceasefire. I see this week that the Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, Penny Wong, they all talk about ceasefire as well. But ceasefire, Keith, in simplistic terms, doesn't ceasefire mean both sides laying down arms?
Well, that's right. And that's what the negotiations over the Gaza Strip have been about. So the United States, Egypt and Qatar have been trying to mediate a ceasefire. Now, with the ceasefire, we would assume that part of the price to be paid would be the release of Palestinian prisoners by Israelis. Netanyahu, the Israeli Prime Minister, by contrast, is saying, we want to completely destroy Hamas. We're not going to negotiate. So there's a big difference there.
But a ceasefire
would mean an end of fighting, but also the release of some of the Palestinians held by Israelis, amongst other things.
And this two-state solution that they've talked about as well this week, Keith, that's never going to happen, is it?
No, not now. You've now got, well, Hamas has never accepted that as an idea, never. And on the other hand, you've got a number of Israeli politicians who have now come out against it. So the only people who talk about a two-state solution are people who don't live in that region, like the Australian government or the American government. But amongst the combatants themselves, they're just saying, no, this is a fight to the finish. We're going to wipe out the other side. And so it's very different from the idea of a two-state solution, which was part of the negotiating process that was revived by the what's called the Oslo Peace Accords 30 years ago. And it actually goes back to a proposal the British made when they were running Palestine in the days of the League of Nations. The British were aware of this influx of Jewish asylum seekers coming in from Europe, fleeing Hitler in Germany. And so the British were confronted with these tensions at community level between the Jewish refugees and the Palestinians who've been living on the land. And it was the British who invented the two-state solution back in 1937-38. And it continues to be revived. The Jews were willing to accept it in the late 1930s, but the Palestinians were not. And that's pretty well how it was continued until the Oslo peace process, when the Palestinians realized that every time they turn it down and a new proposal is made, they get less and less land. So they suddenly came to their senses and started to talk in those terms. But you've still got groups like Hamas and Hezbollah who are saying, no, we want to get rid of the Israelis as the running government of that area, and it's got to be controlled by Palestinians and Arabs.
Just before I let you go, can we touch quickly on the Russia-Ukraine conflict? Now, news came out this week that President Zelensky claims that North Korea is preparing to send 10,000 troops to support Russia in its invasion of Ukraine. Keith, how would North Korea's involvement in the Ukraine conflict change the dynamics of the war?
Well, I think it's more of a political impact than a military one. They'll be sending, by the looks of it, the South Koreans have also said that there's evidence that the Koreans are moving troops in. They're already supplying weaponry. That they've got a lot of old-style Soviet weaponry. So they're really giving back to the Russians what they'd already required during the Cold War years. The key factor, as you say, is now the supply of personnel. The problem is the Russian way of fighting is just to throw troops at the other side using the force of numbers. And so we're now going to be hearing about dead North Koreans on the battlefield. These are troops that have not really had any combat experience. We don't know how they're going to react when they come under fire. Very different from the Ukrainians, who've had a lot of combat experience the last 2.5 years. So we don't know how the North Koreans will react. They're probably not going to be a major impact in terms of changing the nature of the war. I think the war is now so stalemated, it's very hard to see any one single development being the change agent, except perhaps for President Trump being elected as president and his decision to stop supplying American aid to Ukraine. Other than that, I think this is going to be a war that'll drag on to 2025, toward the end of next year. President Zelensky of Ukraine himself is talking in those terms. We've got another year of fighting to go. The North Koreans will be fed into what's called the meat grinder and will end up being killed. I don't think they're going to make a major contribution, but in political terms, it's very important because it shows that there's clearly, in reply to the Western aid for Ukraine, we now have Russia, aided by North Korea and Iran, willing to support Russia in that effort. So politically, it is very significant indeed.
Thank you, Keith. We'll leave it there. We appreciate you taking your time on a Saturday morning to talk to us.
Thank you.
That's Dr. Keith Suter from Global Directions. Jeez, we're in a mess, aren't we? The world is in a mess.